Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and these are The Legacy Tapes, a series of conversations with brilliant artistic directors around ideas of what it means to leave something behind in the ephemeral medium of theatre. And I'm here with Erica Wyman at the RSC on Earlham Street, and she's brilliant. She started life, well, I don't know where you started life, actually, but she's worked at the Tricycle and the ETT as an associate. She was the artistic director at Southwark Playhouse and The Gate. She was part of the first contingent in the Claw leadership scheme. Then she went and ran Northern Stage and did brilliant things, and now she's the associate or assistant artistic director?
Deputy.
Damn it. I did my research and then forgot. Now she's the deputy artistic director at the RSC. And a bit of a... you're a bit of an icon. I think.
That's very funny. That can't be true, but thank you.
And we've just been chatting for about 20 minutes about... well, politics and arts and the world and stuff. So maybe let's start with why on earth do you work in theatre?
Yeah, that is, of course, for me, the most difficult question, genuinely, because I think a lot of artistic directors work in theatre because they're sure that they're really, really brilliant at making theatre. And I get a little more certain as I get older that I am pretty good at making theatre, but what I want to do is shift the way the world thinks and feels. That's what I want to do. So I frequently ask myself whether this is the best way to thread that needle. Mm. And I always have, really. I've had lots of break points in my working life where I've gone, oh, this is ridiculous. I've got to immediately stop because this is definitely the very hardest way to make a difference to the world. Yeah, and then once in a blue moon, you feel like you're making a difference artistically, i.e. on stage, and the only people who are coming are people who knew it already. Or the opposite, you get lots of people to come but you don't feel like you've shifted the way they think or feel. So why do I still do it? I'm actually having an optimistic moment about the theatre, sitting here a few weeks after the referendum. Mm-hmm. Unlike a lot of very demoralising general elections in my life, this was equally demoralising, but those elections had made me often feel like fleeing and doing something else, you know, being working politics or running a charity or just standing up and screaming, which made me more effective than raising a lot of money from complex sources and putting on a play and hoping people will come. And this time I don't feel like that because I feel very clear that we need new stories and we need stories. We need stories in which we can recognise ourselves and imagine a future that we currently cannot imagine. We're struggling, I think, as a nation in all sorts of ways to imagine what our story is going to be. And that's actually, as a theatre maker, that's quite thrilling. Plus, it makes me feel like theatre is not a bad way to try and make a difference. And I suppose that's always been true. Mm-hmm. That's lurked under those doubts. There is one more bit of the answer, which is more eccentric, which is that the one time in my life I moved firmly away from the theatre after university was into philosophy, and I was convinced, albeit briefly, that that's what I wanted to do, and it was a bit lonely for me and not conversational enough, but I think that's, at my best, that is what I do. Programming a theatre and directing plays is a form of sort of active social communitarian philosophy.
Collective philosophy, yeah. That's a really nice thing. Good answer. How is changing the world going? I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Do you know, it's going better than it might have been going, because which comes to your point, I think, I've been with the RSC 3 years, and I for some of that time, and in the months before I took up my post, which was invented for me, I've had very deep, I think totally reasonable doubts about whether from the inside of an institution like the RSC with all its history, you can make enough of a difference. And actually, this year particularly, I've started to feel the benefits of the sheer reach and scale of the RSC and of Shakespeare and Shakespeare's plays. So I'm feeling as though you can change the world just a little bit, because, for example, there's a lot of fear about Shakespeare. There's a lot of conviction or prejudice that he belongs to a certain class of people.
Yeah.
To people who've had a fancy education or university education, or to people who were born seeing his plays or reading his plays, you know, around the fireside in some imagined golden age. Or he belongs to something that sounds like the early days of the BBC, where he was good for you and you ought to understand his plays.
Mm.
Of course,
we should go,
and that it's edifying to go, and it's educational in the worst sense of you go to do something that hurts, but medicinal might be a better word. So we know all that prejudice exists, and we know quite a lot about why. You know, generations of children, young people, of which I was one, taught Shakespeare by sitting around in the classroom reading a line out each and being asked if you understand it. And the language is, you know, 400, 420 years old, so sometimes you don't understand it. And if you aren't playing a part in a story that you can grasp, and you're not speaking it aloud with any sense of drama or action, you're even less likely to understand it. So we know why, but it's really, really easily fixed. So there's a huge pleasure in my current role in seeing children as young as, you know, 5, 6, 7, through to, you know, people in their 80s and 90s discovering Shakespeare for the first time, realising that he doesn't belong to somebody else, he belongs to them. And that most teenagers I know have felt like they want their flesh to melt away. And most people in the latter years of their life have had moments where they think, have I achieved anything at all? Have I got it all wrong? Do my children hate me? Am I losing my mind? You know, I could go on. There are, I've just done Some Night's Dream in this rather unusual production where we worked with 14 different amateur theatre companies in 12 different places around the United Kingdom, which brought lots of amateur actors to the Royal Shakespeare Company, for whom Shakespeare wasn't necessarily something they felt confident to do, and it brought even more, way more people to come and see them,
yeah.
See their mates and see their uncle and see their dad, and fantastic. And meanwhile, there was nearly 600 children from schools again all around the country who took part in Titania's Fairy Train and spoke the fairy blessing at the end of the play. And it's been, for me, it's been a transformative experience of seeing how swiftly people for whom Shakespeare feels alien and strange and unfamiliar and difficult and a bit scary can not only do it, but fall in love with it. Because the idea that someone speaks to us over 400 years and does speak to us about love and dreams and fear and tragedy and the nation and the complexity of trying to rule a nation and all sorts of things that just seem so, so alive and urgent. Yeah, that's not going badly. It does feel like there's something about changing people's minds about Shakespeare that is changing the world in a small way. And meanwhile, I keep putting on programming and directing dangerously difficult plays, which is a different way of changing the world, because handfuls of people see them and lots of those people have thought some of those things before. But I feel like they're a kind of rehearsal for stories we need to tell about ourselves that are really difficult to articulate.
Mm-hmm.
So we need our playwrights to begin to articulate them. So I worry less than I used to that the people who come and see those plays might in the main be people who are already thinking either radical thoughts or dare I say it, socialist thoughts or thoughts about the really hard to say things, you know, about race, for example, or gender or inequality or poverty, or they're hard to talk about those things. We need our writers to say them. We need actors to put those words in their mouths and to find ways of practicing saying those difficult things in order to, I think, to start telling new stories about ourselves.
Yeah, because if you've seen someone say it, then it's safer for you to say it one day.
And if you've seen someone say it and you felt something, whether you felt anger, or as though you've been misrepresented, or as you firmly don't agree, or whether you felt something that's more like recognition, you felt something cathartic or something sympathetic, either way, you have opened up a possibility that will make it more possible to have that conversation and that debate. And in fact, I sometimes think it's more powerful when you see something that you violently disagree with, because you come out furiously defending what you do think about the world, and that's good too.
Yeah, and I think sometimes just letting I think when I really disagree, or things that make me really angry, it's rare I see things I disagree with because, you know, I'm an arty theatre person, but things that make me angry for whatever reason, and I come out in these blind rages, and just figuring out why I'm so bloody angry is really useful.
It's touched a nerve of some kind.
Yeah. And sometimes it's about, I mean, sometimes it's just about the sheer cost of that particular piece of scenery and what I could do with that.
Sure.
But other times I think it tends to be about assumptions or about lasinesses. Like I saw, before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about dialects and how people speak, and I saw a production set in the East Midlands in which, in a mining, it was about the mines, and someone said, I'm just going to eat my cob, and got out these amazing, like, Kingsmill sandwiches, and I was so angry, the person I was with had to hold me down, because a cob is it's a crusty cob, like, if you're from the Midlands, you know what that is, and it made me so angry that the people making that piece had been so careless.
Yes.
With my history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it felt like class tourism, cultural tourism. It made me angry. I'm still going on about it.
Yeah, there are many things that make me angry, but one of them is the casual assumption that you can get an actor to do a Geordie accent. Because you mainly can't, A. And B, why would you? And there are so many fantastic North East actors. But we do casually assume that we can just put on other people's clothes. Of course, that is partly what acting is. Of course it is. And versatility is thrilling, and I work for an organisation, unusually, still operates a very thoroughgoing rep system, so you might have to be a Geordie in one play and a fancy king from the South East, although hopefully that will change too in the next play. But still, I think you're right, I think careless is a very good word. We are careless with what we consider to be authenticity. And we do everyone a disservice because we're not giving people jobs. As well as not intelligently representing people's culture. Mm.
I think also the thing that made me really cross is there was a 16, 17 year old lad next to me and his dad just sitting next to me, and they come from the town where this play was set to watch it. Were so and they were like, it's not a cop, like, it's not,
yeah,
is
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And we had our little thing. But the cost of a London theatre ticket and a train to London, like, I remember trying to do that and it costing everything I could scrape together. It's a bloody fortune.
Yeah.
So the very least you can do is be respectful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. However, I think the other thing that we don't do well is give status and frame thoroughly work that is made all around this country. Mm. You know, the question always arises, should it come to London, i.e. is it going to be a commercial hit? As opposed to, should more people see it? Should more people see it, and how can we make that happen? And occasionally it happens, but you're reminding me of a project at Northern Stage that I was very proud of, and it was a really particular conversation about how to make that piece, which was an adaptation of the novel Apples by Richard Millward. And having to explain to quite a lot of Southerners that Middlesbrough is not Newcastle, and then they go, oh, I know that. Nonetheless, assuming that people might talk with a similar accent, which they don't, and the particularities of some great stuff in there about particular bits of food and drink that you can only get in Teesside. And then I remember Daniel Bai wrote a brilliant piece. Did you see it?
About the dinner, about the light.
Oh, no.
Oh, right, you tell me about your
Daniel
Bai.
Oh, he wrote a piece about the accents.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, Dan was already quite an established theatre maker and, you know, moving in all sorts of different circles. Not somebody lacking confidence, certainly from the outside, although he may disagree. And he wrote this beautiful piece in response to Apples that was simply about the great pleasure of hearing your voice on stage. And that just changing everything. And of course, it's really particularly interesting with the North East voice because people were shocked that he didn't consider that he'd heard his own voice with endless Newcastle voices or Gateshead voices and Northumberland voices, but he hadn't heard his voice.
That piece is a brilliant piece, and there's another one that he wrote not long after, or slightly, I think not long after, slightly before, about seeing a play from the North East in which people sit down to dinner. And it was lit as though it was the evening. Was like, no, dinner's lunch, which I think is his. That's my his dinner is my cob. I think.
Exactly. Yeah, no, we are casual about it and careless, and we do ourselves no favours.
And I think there's an interesting thing that, like, because I'm from the Midlands and I grew up seeing. Once I was at school, I saw a lot of things at the RSC. We used to go in trips, coaches. It was very exciting. And try and drink in the pub when we were underage before the show and all that stuff. And I remember seeing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream. And the only time I'd ever heard a Midlands voice, and they were Brummie voices on the stage at the RSC, and it was the Mechanicals, and they were idiots. I was like, guys, are you doing to me?
Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing, that dream, but which we can talk about. But I don't think that play is mocking those six men and women in my production, men in Shakespeare's mind at all. That's not mocking at all. He thinks it's hilarious trying to watch people take terribly seriously the endeavour to put on a play when they don't know how to begin to do it. That's very funny, but it's not at their expense, because he also really respects how bloody hard it is and how and with how much dignity they attempt to do it. That's partly why we laugh.
Yeah.
And it's almost always played as mocking Andram, but there wasn't any Andram. He was writing about people with jobs, you know, carpenters and joiners and bellows menders who were not amateur actors in their spare time. You know, Quince knows a little bit about putting a play on, but only really the basics, and very much from a carpenter's perspective. Props list, a list, a plan, a schedule, that's all you need. But he's got a bit of a gift for verse, and Bottom knows actually slightly less. He's obviously seen a few fabulous performances and is really up for getting himself a bit of what that feels like.
I can say, I can't criticise that. That's totally why I do this.
Completely. Completely. It's why we all do it, isn't it? I mean, there is Bottom in all of us, I think. But anyway, yeah, I agree. There is something entirely central to Shakespeare's writing about that bit of the world, actually. And I mean, a project that I was really proud of was my first year at the RSC. I did a Phil Porter play about the true story of the Christmas truce in 1914 on the Western Front. And one of the reasons I loved making that, it was very affecting to make that 100 years after the truce itself, and to be in the Royal Shakespeare Theatre on Christmas Eve and to have the company try and tell that story exactly 100 years since it happened. All of that was fabulous. But a thing I thought might not be possible at the RSC that was very possible in Newcastle was touching people with recognition. So the opposite of your cop story. Yes. You know, there was a brilliant laugh every night when we talked about football. That was a particular sort of dark, slightly hollow laugh from the West Brom supporters. And just hear again to hear that in Stratford, in that sort of crucible of national and international theatre making, is heaven. Because that is theatre. It's not the only thing you can do in the theatre. You can also make people imagine a world they've never dreamt of. But when you see yourself, when you feel like you are on stage, then something's possible that wasn't possible before. And these stories in which people are heroic, for example, or honest, emotionally honest, which is a form of heroism, I think, makes us bigger than ourselves, makes it more possible for us to reach further, be more honest ourselves.
And also, there's something about seeing, coming back to something I think we might be talking about before I turn the recorder on, but something about seeing someone that's you, that's like you, that could be you on stage, in this, in the cultural narrative.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
It makes it embiggens you. It makes you worthy of being part of that in a way that if you grow up in a lot of places, you would never conceive of.
Yeah, the narrative belongs to other people, and you, therefore your story is ignored. And I did. It's a story that the story I'm about to tell has been told in a few places because it's touched us so much. But a parent in a school we work with had been quite sceptical about the school working with the RSC because they'd been worried that, well, the parents there were worried that either the RSC didn't mean it and we'd let them down, or that we would raise people's expectations in a way that couldn't be fulfilled by the world, which I find absolutely devastating. The idea that children might have a glimpse of, and as you say, being part of that cultural narrative, having an ownership and a confidence about part of our cultural heritage that lives, that isn't heritage, no, that's it. That would be bad for them, because life will only let them down and tell them that they can't do anything with that. So there was a raft of scepticism in this particular school from the parents, and one of the children came on a trip as part of the partnership to see Merchant of Venice in Stratford. I think the play is interesting here, because it's a play about everybody's rights, and it's a play about everybody's intolerance, everybody's prejudice.
Mm.
But anyway, he went back home, got his mum to come to Stratford, which actually a huge investment for her, massive. They came, as I understand it, she came with him as a second visit, so they had to travel to Stratford and buy tickets to the show. It wasn't part of the relationship with school. Anyway, she came and she wrote a letter to her mistress saying, "I've completely changed my mind, and I get it. And I thought it was, you know, fabulous and fascinating, and it's made me want to vote." And I find that very, very heartening, at the exact same time as I'm made miserable by how disenfranchised people feel in our country, from any kind of narrative, cultural, political. But I find it very heartening that seeing a story about a series of merchants in a London that none of us recognise, told in a modern dress production, brilliantly told in my view by Polly Findlay, to make us see the connections between the intolerance in our own society and in Shakespeare's play, made someone want to vote, made her think that her voice mattered, that it was worth bothering to vote. It's very moving, and I think that, I mean, I do think the plays do suggest exactly that. I think she's very smart to identify that is what they do, is say that full stuff matters as much as Hal, that the mechanicals matter as much as Theseus and Polity. He does it time and time again, the comedies and the tragedies. You know, that Romeo and Juliet have more to tell that society than the chief of police. You know, that there is a sense in which it's always in the unexpected place that you will find the most, either the most radical or the most transformative view of power. And you make it hard for people to see clearly when they have real power. So he's consistently getting us to see ourselves as part of a dialogue and a narrative. And all the best theatre does do that. But we do, I think we live through particularly bleak times in that regard, and I think we've gone backwards.
So one of the questions that I'm asking people is, did you think about legacy? Like when you took any of the jobs, at the point at which you took the job, were you thinking about what you wanted to leave behind? Is that something that enters into your ponderings?
No, maybe until this one, weirdly. This one behaved slightly differently. I did think about it as I was on the brink of leaving those jobs, but I didn't think about it in advance, no. I suppose in advance you just want to grab it and try and wrestle it, make it work. And I, you know, Northern Stage was the most challenging way, most transformative and most rewarding of those jobs, because it was a very difficult moment in the life of Northern Stage, and I took over in the middle of a capital project, but a vision that went before me that had seen its golden years and had sort of fallen away, and the company didn't really know what its identity was, whether it belonged to that vision, or whether it needed to find an entirely new way of thinking, or whether there was an older version from the origins of Newcastle Playhouse. It was very muddled about its identity. It had money to finish building the theatre, but the theatre building was completely delayed and stuck, and the city had seen a lot of capital development, and it was a very exciting time in Newcastle and Gateshead, very exciting, you know, money really there to try and find a brand new cultural identity for that place. And successfully so, I think. However, for Northern Stage, we were like the poor sister to a number of those projects at that point. And I'd never worked there. I didn't know the city. I had to get to know it. I had a team that was very sad and not quite the right shape. So I had to make some difficult decisions about the team to take it forward. So it was really, really hard. So no, I didn't think about legacy. I just thought about getting through a year. Really. Yeah. Just think about running away. Well, if I can't pull off these seven things that all feel like they require a miracle, I'll just have to go.
Yeah.
And if I really haven't pulled them off, no one will mind. I'll go, thank God she's gone. You know,
yeah.
She couldn't do it. So I used to think about that. Whereas 7 years on, because it was an incredible satisfaction to make most of those things happen. I had a happy team, it's a brilliant building, a sense of its place in the city, and the beginnings of its place in national theatrical life, which I hadn't had for a while. And some amazing collaborations across the city and across the country. I did start thinking about how do you leave with good grace? How do you hand this to somebody? What is it you should be trying to protect? Anything? You know, should you just say, okay, that I did my bit and it's yours now?
Mm.
Mostly you should do that. But what I did was the St. Stephen's project in Edinburgh, which was a kind of legacy project. So I guess I knew, I didn't have the job at the RSC, but I did know I was getting towards wanting to do something else. And I wasn't going to go until I had found a platform for Northern Stage that was outside of Newcastle and could attract national criticism and artists from a wider reach, and would sort of put a marker down as to the significance of work being made in the North East.
Mm.
I was very frustrated at people not noticing what amazing things are happening in the North East by then. So that has something to do with legacy, yeah.
And then when you started, because you started at the RSC, and like there must be filing cabinets of other people's legacies when you arrive.
Yeah,
it
does make sense. I mean, I think Greg would probably say that actually, that, you know, particularly because he had been there 25 years then.
Yeah.
So he'd lived through a lot of those legacies.
Yeah.
He'd seen them come and go.
But there hasn't been another one.
But there hasn't been a deputy artistic director. There had been associate directors. It was a very different system. It has something in common with those associates. So there's a history of challenging the artistic director. There's a history of being the grit in the ointment for artistic strategy. But what there isn't is placing one person really kind of very close to the artistic director to make that strategy together. It's still true that, you know, part of my job is to nudge and be the grit. But there was a very specific thing that Greg did, which is to ask me to head up on thinking around new work, which I do very closely with Pippa Hill, the literary manager.
Mm.
But that has morphed, I suppose, into being, I partly insisted on being this, of being a kind of guardian of making sure we're relevant, which is cared about by everyone at the RSC. It's very, very easy to take your eye off that when audiences are, we're very fortunate, they will come to see the plays, sort of whatever we do. They'll then tell us it's rubbish or tell us it's irrelevant, but they'll come, which is not true almost anywhere else. And so our task is to try and get new people to come, to find space for that, and to make sure that all of those audiences are engaged in a debate that feels genuinely contemporary. So I suppose I thought, in terms of predecessors, I thought about Peter Hall and his relationship to new writing, and for, you know, amazingly adventurous new writing, formerly adventurous, thinking about his relationship to Beckett, for example, focuses the mind somewhat. Of course about Peter Brook and the way that he tackled Shakespeare and thought about Shakespeare. But also, what's been a huge influence on me is Buzz Goodbody and the story of what she did at the other place and her relationship to Trevor Nunn, and, you know, that he backed her, and that there was a sense in which there was an appetite and a permission to be as daring as that with the smaller work. I mean, she did a lot of Shakespeare, which I'm not doing in the other place. But she also was an activist, and she had a very loud political conscience that I think was very, very good for the RFC. Mm. So in that sense, I was mindful of a lot of people's legacies. But I suppose what I meant by, and I thought about my own, was as deputy, your influence, if you aren't good at it, your influence would be visible in the wrong sense. So if I wasn't good at it, my fear was that it would be really clear that Greg thought one thing and I thought another, because he's the artistic director, so we do what he wanted to do. To be good at it, I think, it's still quite early days, is to create an environment where those two instincts can really feed each other. Mm-hmm. So I think a bit more like him than I used to, and I like to think he thinks more like me than he used to, and that's then a cocktail. So actually the RSC is speaking with one voice, but that has all its riches. And the two particular things in there, of course, are about diversity and about national, which is what we were talking about, national relevance and national, true national distribution of our work. Mm. There's lots of things I care about, but those two things, you know, I just bang on about it ceaselessly until people listen, because I can't cope with the idea of an RSC that doesn't take those things seriously. Mm.
And do you... it was interesting hearing you say that, because at Overhouse, Rachel and I were a co-directorship. Mm. And we arrived as close friends, and then we went through a period of really bloody hating each other. I think we did speak, but there was a period where we didn't want to speak to each other, and we you know, actually had to put in a formal structure to sort our shit out. And it was brilliant. I'm so glad that we went through a year of... Mm. I'm so sorry to all the people that got kind of fell by the wayside in that time, but in terms of understanding now what it is to provoke and to collaborate and to be the grit in the oyster. Mm. God, that was useful.
I have found it easier than I thought I would, because I've been in charge for a long time. I mean, a long time. I took over at Southwark in 1998, so, you know, long time. And it's both bliss and hell, of course, as you know, being in charge, because the buck stops with you. But you can make change because you have decided you're going to. If you do it well, you've consulted properly, and you know you have the buy-in, or at the very least, you know exactly what people's anxieties are about that change, and you can take care of those anxieties while insisting on that change. If you're not in charge, that's not true. You can only nudge. And I'm very grateful to Greg for giving me, I couldn't wish for a better platform in terms of really being able to debate with him how we go forward. He gives me a lot of room, and he listens brilliantly. But I think I'm also ready for it, because the thing that's lovely about being deputy, it's a bit dangerous to own up, but you can say the thing that no one wants to hear. If you're in charge, you've got to reach a place that is the direction of travel, is where you're going to go. Mm-hmm. So occasionally, of course, we all want to say, but isn't it infuriating that we have to move so slowly? Or isn't it infuriating that in spite of everything we've done to change perceptions, the perception hasn't changed?
Yeah.
And there is something I enjoy about that bit of my job, of it being useful sometimes for me to say that, because I don't have to then, of course I help us to hone, I like to think I help us to hone that into an actual strategy, but sometimes it's just useful to hear the other side of things. So that's been liberating. And I think being an artistic director is incredibly lonely. I loved it. Being sole artistic director, I loved it. But I actually surrounded myself with lots of people in different kinds of roles that could provide that collaboration. So it doesn't feel wholly new. It's just a shift in the balance, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess the other thing is that there's a specific thing I've been asked to do, which is to bring what I know and what I think to the role, which is not always, you're not always confident that that's what's happened. And that it's in itself makes it more possible to be dipped. Because I've effectively been trusted with being myself.
Yeah. You know, in old maps, there are those pictures of clouds blowing wind.
Yeah.
You're kind of that sounds awful. I just heard that out loud and realised it sounds awful.
It's very funny, but I know exactly
but
what you mean.
But you're kind of, there's this slight influence on the direction of travel.
Yeah, and sometimes that feels like wrestling with soup. Of course it does. It's the Royal Shakespeare Company. They're very old. They're very big. Lots of people find us infuriating. Sometimes we're infuriating. So, you know, of course it's hard, that, and frustrating, but I've been impressed for 3 years at how far we are prepared to bend and change and reshape ourselves. And there are ways in which we've wanted to reshape ourselves for a long time, but we haven't had the opportunity.
Yeah.
So I have been impressed. To go back to your question, I did want to say a little thing about leaving the gate.
Mm-hmm.
So the gate was very influential because it was very hard. It was the hardest job I've done. I've just said North Social is a huge set of challenges, probably the biggest suite of initial challenges I've had. The gate didn't look as hard as it turned out to be. The gate was rising high when I took over. It was an exciting time for directors. It's a long time ago. It was the millennium. But it was a much more celebrity-led culture in London. We were very excited about fancy Hollywood actors playing random parts that they were or were not suited for. And the press was quite hostile to ideas, to philosophy.
Mm.
I was interested in the story of the celebrity, whether that was the actor or the director.
Oh, because it was the early days of full-on rampant neoliberalism.
That's right, as we now see it.
As we now see it. Ah, hindsight. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I had missed that, I think. Or if I hadn't, maybe I hadn't missed it, but I couldn't believe it was going to rule the world.
Mm.
It was really going to be the benchmark. And it really was going to be a benchmark. And I set out in that job to follow the mission. The mission I received as a director is a completely brilliant one, which is to introduce the unfamiliar to London through international theatre. What better, more thrilling mission, particularly if you're someone who's interested in ideas and difficult questions and politics. And the world. The world really felt like my oyster. In this tiny space, so huge financial constraints, I don't want to tell you about that, but you know, there's a challenge in that, there's a thrill in that. And there's a permission in that. You can dare. And I thought, and I was right in the end, but that you could fail in that. But failure was unbelievably painful in that climate. And I basically battled with the critics and my board for 4 years, where they just kept saying, this is irritatingly worthy. And none of the things I did was worthy in the sense of being straightforward message plays or being in aid of charitable causes. They were all much weirder than that. I mean, worthy just didn't get near to how eccentric and intriguing they were. But I found that incredibly painful, and it made me almost every day want to stop doing theatre. In fact, when I left, I said very clearly, I don't want to run that theatre ever again, which is comedy, of course. But I meant it. However, as I left, partly because the world turned, so the wake of 9/11 and 7/7, what has happened in the years between. So it's pre-crash by quite a long way, but I think the sense that our world wasn't stable had really taken hold in the years I was at Kate. As I left, a series of different journalists, independently, said, what a fantastic tenure. And I was totally flummoxed. I mean, I had felt like I was in a battle.
You could have told me while I was there,
yeah.
Gits.
And I think what they meant was, I stuck to my guns.
Mm.
I had a set of principles that I was pursuing. I didn't think that I was being belligerent or stubborn. I genuinely didn't know what else to do there. Those were the things I wanted to do with that remit and that space. But I did learn a lesson that your legacy has got almost nothing to do with how it feels at the time.
Mm. Thank God.
Do you think
more about do you think more about long term planning or short term survival generally? And I think maybe there's also something about stability versus innovation.
Yeah, this is hard, of course, because I have, which is moderately unusual, but I have moved from, I've moved upscale every time I've moved role.
Mm.
So it is true that I thought more about survival. I felt only about survival at South Playhouse. I mean, only.
Mm.
It was the only thing I ever thought about, really. You know, there were moments of going, well, if we do that, we'll stay alive and it might be good. But it was wild, seat of the pants, frontier town. The gate was moderately more stable, and while I was there we had some what would now be called portfolio funding for the first time. But I thought about survival artistically every day, as described. Northern Stage, I thought about survival for the first 2 years, and then I started to be able to think long, and I loved it. Actually, I loved thinking long, because you can start, what I really discovered is the longer term you think, the braver the people around you are with the short term, because they start by osmosis implementing the long term ambition.
Mm.
But if you take the present out of their reach, so we would have these crazy strategic planning meetings that I loved, where I'd say, look, it's going to be different people in 10 years time, so let's think about 10 years where we imagine all of us would have left, and if we haven't, we've seen everything under the sun. What would we want it to be then? And what would happen almost every time? You'd have a little clutch of ambitions that really would take 10 or 20 or maybe 100 years.
Mm.
But the vast majority of things we said in those conversations, we could implement immediately, so we did. So strategically, I think the long term is terribly, terribly good for everybody. And of course, I say that because now I have the luxury of a level of stability I've never known. The Arts Council could have the courage to withdraw funding from the RSC completely, but it doesn't look terribly likely, and we work very hard to earn our keep in terms of how we use our resources and how we raise our money. Proportionately, that public funding, whilst it is huge, is a smaller proportion than almost any other arts organisation or any other theatre organisation. So, there is stability just in that. In how much money we raise to contribute to the total. So there is stability like I've never known. And therefore, the long term is exciting, but it makes me use tools that I used to use at Southwark and the Gate to ensure that there's a bit of the RSC moving fast enough, responding enough.
Yeah.
So the mystery festivals at the other place have been all about that, saying, nope, we're going to commission people and give them very little time to write, hardly any design time. By RSC standards, hardly any. It's all sort of borrowing from the best of the fringe models, but with the glorious resources of the teams at the RSC to support those artists.
So you get that nimbleness, but with the glory.
Well, in the, when it works, yeah, you do. I mean, sometimes it's maddening, of course, because you go, well, why can't I have this? Because over there they've got these huge automated sets, and people get excited about it. And so you just say no quite a lot and explain why not. But yeah, you do need a bit of fast and furious to be genuinely responsive.
Mm.
So I think about both. I'm less anxious about survival. The other place, of course, I mean, the projects don't survive if they're no good. So creating a narrative that might get purchased, and the other place itself, the festivals, Dream for that matter, could have just fallen apart if it hadn't got some kind of purchase.
Mm.
So that is a different form, isn't it? Worrying about survival. I do remember every day how lucky I am to have that stability.
Good.
And that it isn't always good for people.
That's kind of nice to hear from someone who's still at the gates, the gate level.
Yeah,
it's still desperate.
Some of the very best work I've ever seen has been made on a daft shoestring, and I don't mean we shouldn't fund that work. I mean we should fund that work properly, but its scale and its speed of thought can be electrifying. Mm-hmm.
So without in any way wishing you an early demise, what, you know, in 100 years, when they're putting your, I don't know, page in the tome of British theatre or whatever, you know, whatever matters, what do you want it to say? Or maybe this is two parts. Maybe this is what you want it to say and what should it say?
It's very hard. It's very hard, I think, because I'm so hard bitten about what it will say. which I resist. I don't want it to say, she was the first woman to. I don't want to say that, really. I think it's the least interesting thing about me. My commitment to gender equality amongst other equalities, I'd love it to say something about that, but she was a woman, which is effectively what that sentence means.
Yeah.
I really hope it doesn't say that. I hope in 100 years they won't find that interesting. But there we are. They might. I'd like it to say that I was principled, that I had a set of values about how to live in the world that are very well modelled by the best kind of theatre and by the best kind of theatre making. And I stuck to them in spite of all kinds of external influences that would have me work differently, work to a different goal, work in a different way, work with more noise about my work. I think maybe what I'm telling you is what I'm most proud of, that, you know, as I get into a different bit of my life, I'm 46, I haven't actually wavered very often from wanting to make theatre because it is a collaborative art, because it is truly about everybody's voice in one's rehearsal room having a value, and everyone needing to know exactly what that contribution is in order to make kind of a marvellous whole that is greater than its parts. And that model of making is a pretty brilliant example of how human beings can work together and live together. And the other models of theatre making that are, are cheaper. You know, I don't mean money. I mean that's the expensive version of living, is to work together with people and genuinely listen to them and trust a voice that isn't like yours. That's what diversity is really about, is really trusting that a voice that you've never heard before brings at least equal value to your room as yours does. That principle. That works slightly against a lot of the external influences on the theatre industry, indeed on every industry, which is, as you were saying before, the sort of neoliberal voice that says, yeah, but what's the story? What's the story? What's the story? Why should I buy it? In my experience, audiences are immensely reasonable, sometimes unbelievably ambitious human beings who most theatre makers don't have the slightest interest in. And if you extend that circle of collaboration to the audience, amazing things happen.
Mm.
But we get stuck in ivory towers, we get stuck in a sort of simplistic version of marketing that treats potential audience members as idiots. And if we really think about what it costs to decide to go to the theatre, good grief. I mean, so I'd like to be remembered for someone who really got it about audiences. I'm always so grateful. You know, they booked a babysitter, they probably booked parking or a train ticket or both. And as we know from booking patterns, the women have persuaded the men The men wanted to do something else, and they had to pick up a brochure and tell the story we find so hard to tell. They had to tell it to their husband or their brother or their dad. And
not waver when
boyfriend.
They grumbled.
No, and not wavered, exactly, and pursued it and put up with the guys going, do I have to dress up, and are we going to eat, and can I have a drink? Oh, no, because of the parking. Oh, the hell that it mostly is for people to go to theatre. I just think it's amazing.
Mm.
And if we treated that with proper respect, we would diversify our audiences. Because the people we think about, it's their hobby, it's their thrill, so it's like breathing. None of that's hard because it's the thing they want to do 3 nights a week or 4 nights a week. They're not normal, we're not normal. So that, audiences, genuine respect for audiences, genuine respect for collaboration, and that the theatre is a crucible for ideas and progress of ideas, not a dirty idea in itself.
Mm.
It's not elitist to think that theatre is a really very good and very democratic crucible for ideas.
Yeah.
It was actually ever thus.
You said something really interesting. I'm writing a thing about, just a consultation thing about what cutting edge is in the theatre just now. Because I think what the future of theatre is, I think and it's sort of happening now, is democratisation, is what, like, you know, the Fun Palace movement and that kind of, that sort of thing has begun to kick in. And because if we're going to survive, if these buildings, it's the bloody buildings, they're expensive, if they're going to survive, everyone has to own them and come to them. And then I think the other one might be kindness. And I think this is a thing that I've probably stolen from Alan Lane, and that sense that it's the only place you go where you're not consuming.
Yeah. And that is part of the difficulty with not being gracious towards our audiences, is that they are consuming.
Mm.
It is a transaction. They are buying a ticket, mostly, because it's delicious when they're not. But they are mostly, and that's okay, because there is a value placed on the experience by buying the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
But if we treat them as though they've bought a pillowcase or a can of tomatoes, better example, we will misunderstand the nature of that relationship. And that's right, it is, they are, Alan is very good at the fact that they are guests. We are hosts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just the front of house team, that's the event that is hosting them in our environment that we have created. And we can choose whether to make that environment, as you can with any offer to a guest, whether you make it kind of wonderfully unfamiliar, you hold people's hand into something that is, for example, really formal. There can be huge pleasures if you know the code and you confidently given the code. And there can be, we all love dressing up for a wedding. We don't go, oh Lord, I've got to dress up, I don't know how to behave. We love it, it's a sense of occasion.
Of course.
The North East, every Friday night you dress up.
One of the things that my mum complains about is that there aren't now opportunities to dress up.
I think we simplify the problem. We say we've got to, by democratising, what we mean is everything's got to be relaxed. All convention has to be wrecked. The convention is satisfying, whether that is the convention of a festival where nobody is dressed up and the artists and the audience are the same people, or the conventions of formality that say, oh, this is an occasion, and I've saved some money to do this, and it's a big deal for me. They're, and everything in between. Those conventions need to be owned, need to be held confidently, and you wouldn't invite someone to your house with a set of conventions without telling them what they are and how they should prepare. But it can be quite fun to tell them those things. It's this kind of event, this is what we do at Christmas, you know, that stuff.
Yeah.
That's what I think the theatre's got to get much better at, is really putting its arms out and saying, we can still, if we want to, produce a 3-hour play that was written 400 years ago, but we need to assure you on what you need to do in advance. And stop saying, oh, it's for everybody, because that does not assure people that they can get over the various thresholds they see in their way. And yeah, the work of Slum Low or People United, or, you know, people who are really exploring sort of radical kindness, really, is, I agree, is thrilling. I think kindness is also increasingly a very difficult thing to practice. It's harder when you are divided. It's easier when you think you aren't. So it's going to become very important to work out how we are kind. And you talk about how, you know, he was in Stratford in the last weeks of Dream with the Fairy Portal Camp.
Yeah.
And there was absolute heaven for me in that being a collaboration with the Royal Shakespeare Company, that didn't matter at all to the people who came, that it was free, that it was a complete alternative. And yet he, you know, he's a dear and thorough artist, absolutely channeled the potential meaning of fairies as seen through my eyes, Greg's eyes, and Stratford-upon-Avon's eyes. So the continuum, so there are ways in which you can draw a line between totally informal, completely inviting, easy to come to engagement, that therefore can be transformative in its kindness, and walking through the door and buying a ticket. And also it's terribly important, one doesn't have to lead to the other. You know, that's the thing that is, I think, dying away, this idea that audience development is about building loyal audience members. The world has changed, and what we've got to build is goodwill, which might be the match of kindness. We have to be kind in order to build goodwill towards culture, and then we will be much better placed to experience it together, wherever we experience it.
I'm going to stop there, because I feel like that's the best... That's a really good ending. thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.